Hi, this is bloggingheads.tv, a special edition on the Arab Spring and has it passed Jordan by. My name is Jillian Schwedler. I'm a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Hi, Jillian. I'm Hisham Bustani. I'm a writer. I'm also an activist and was active in many organizations that are related to liberties and freedoms and political activism in Jordan. And I'm happy to be here.
Great. I'm happy to have a conversation with you, too. The news here is saturated, of course, with the news about the Arab Spring. It's been absolutely an extraordinary year. We have here also the Occupy Wall Street protests that are emerging. And so news of Jordan is just not making it, on the headlines here. There's bits and pieces showing up. But in some ways, it seems that I think people have the sense that the king has been successful in preempting a revolution happening in Jordan. What do you think is happening there? You're on the ground in Amman
right
now.
Well, I think, trying to describe things in Jordan as a revolution are very, a very optimistic stroke on that side. I never thought that in Jordan the movement started very slow. It started with reform slogans, a thing that the Jordanian regime has been talking about for the past 5 years. Also, Julian, that there's a lot of problems within the social structure of Jordan. There's this manufactured division of identity between those of a Palestinian origin and those of a Jordanian origin. And the movement itself has adopted this manufactured division amongst its ranks. We have seen a transformation in the political speech among the political elites towards magnifying these divisions, which would ultimately not contribute well to the development of a protest movement, because segments of the population will not feel relaxed that other segments are with them or against them or so on. This play has been going on for a while now, and it's surprising that the political movements, that the new political movements, have actually jumped in on this speech and is trying to use it. I don't think it's doing any much benefit on that regard. Maybe another factor is that there's no really, the movement itself is elitist. It's not really a popular movement.
So is it a unified movement that's happening there, or are there?
Completely not. It's also, this is another problem, that you have a many wide variation of factions that are participating, and they're not really, how can I say this? They are not, for example, there are many divisions over very minor issues, that like the elections law. What sort of reform do we need? What is the meaning of reform regarding corruption? What is corruption? Who are the corrupt people? How can we deal with corruption? There are factions ranging from the Islamists up to, neo-fascists who are, pro-withdrawing nationalities from the Palestinians and these kind of Jordanians from a Palestinian origin on these kind of issues. So there's a huge, it's unhomogeneous, it's non-homogeneous, this movement. It does not have, unlike what happened, for example, in Egypt or Tunisia or other parts of the Arab region, where there was a clear slogan. It might be not a very deep thing to remove the head of state, but even here we don't have such a clear slogan against the regime or against the monarchy or against the established system. They are more or less trying to turn the piece of cake towards, everybody's trying to move the piece of cake towards his own, his own table. And this is what's actually, this is how I see things going on in Amman at the moment.
So protests, started on a weekly basis, even, last January and February, and have been going on basically every week. Are they organized across the different groups sometimes? Are they always the separate group organized? Because we hear here, we saw a few pictures of Salafis organized with, holding up swords, and that was pretty provocative. And the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, comes out. The March 24th and 25th sit-in got a little bit of attention because it turned a bit violent. So it seems that there's no sense of these groups coming together, in part, I think, because they don't share the same desire to get rid of the king.
No, they do actually come together, but they come together, as I told you, on very wide, undefined slogans, like, you know, reform. For example, I give you examples. The Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan, they want election reform based on, as you know, the Jordanian parliament, it has a non-representative number of parliamentary representatives representing the population. They're not representing the population, but they are mainly representing the different regions in Jordan. There's not enough weight on the number of population. More weight is directed towards the actual peripheries, so that there will be more representation of the regions outside the cities. The Muslim Brotherhood wants a shift in this, whereas other parts of the protest movement, they want an election law favoring the same geographical distribution, the same thing. They want more representation on lower population regions outside the cities, because they think that there are more people from East Jordanian descent and concentrated on these regions. Such differences on very minute issues would actually facilitate the manipulation of the movement by the regime itself. And there are lots of people who are leading the demonstrations actually these days. They are in continuous meetings. They are in declared meetings with the figures from the government and from the regime. So I think what's happening in Jordan mainly is a struggle within the context or the fabric of the regime between the old guard, who were marginalized by the new era in Jordan, and between the new guard, who came along with the new king later on. I think there's a power struggle in between those two groups, and this has manifested in this way as we see it today.
So the old guard, are you including in the old guard the various tribal groupings? Because in some ways it seems that what the regime has done is it set itself up to be in this very problem. So it's continued to rely on, you know, support base from various tribal groupings outside of the city. It's consistently alienated the Palestinian population through gerrymandering in the elections, an electoral system that is, you know, blatantly unfair and exclusionary. And so on one hand, it's relied on tribes for support. On the other hand, the tribes are, you know, really pushing back now as well. I mean, we hear of shutting down the highway in the south, et cetera. So, I mean, is there an increase in tribal violence or tribal pushback, or is this something new?
I think yes. What you're saying is mainly during the reign of King Hussein, the regime itself was supported, as you said, by these pillars, by the tribal pillars. And for me, there was a sort of division of what came out of the corruption system, where when you are representing the leaders of the tribes within the regime itself, then some money from the corruption would tunnel down through these tribal leaders into the tribes themselves, and you have a wider distribution, let's say, of a corrupt system. With the new king, we have seen a more business-oriented, a more neoliberal, if you want, era where there was no longer the need to incorporate the tribal leaders. There was sort of trying to, you know.
So they're angry. Are they pissed off? They're feeling alienated.
Yeah. So the tribal leaders were a little bit pushed away, and the new class of businessmen, let's say, were fully in charge. That was during, let's say, 2002 up to 2000. And 6-7. So there was a huge marginalization of the peripheries, And there was this, let's say, the leaders of the tribes and the tribal structures, they were aggravated, angered by this, and they were trying to re-establish the old system. And I think they are succeeding in a way or another. So the thrust for change in Jordan is not really a change of system or a change of regime, but rather to re-establish the old system where the tribal leaders are represented within the regime themselves and are part of the system of, you know, that rules the country and distributes whatever comes out of this. You know, Jordan has no industry, it's completely reliant on foreign aid on one side, and it has privatized completely everything from the telecom companies up to the mining industry. So within this structure, the tribal leaders are trying to get back into the system, and for me there is no big change in that. There is nobody. Let me give you an example about, for example, the constitutional reform that has been very much welcomed and hailed by many parts of the protest movement, not all of them, and but they do still join protests together despite,
Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions. It seems sort of, you know, given that context, which I fully agree with, you know, this effort for constitutional reforms seems almost destined to fail. I mean, how can it possibly, you know, alleviate the situation and bring real reform when you're getting, you know, certain groups that want the old guard back in, certain groups that want substantive reform and significant inclusion, particularly of the Palestinian population? You have a new economic elite that has its own interests that aren't necessarily aligned, I mean, frankly, with economic with democratic reform. So, you know, what is the king thinking? I mean, how can this possibly really, really appease everyone?
If you look at the reform, you know, or the what has been reformed, actually what we have now is a more regressive, if you want, constitution than what we had before. Let me tell you what, if we want to talk about constitutional reform in Jordan, the main problem is that all the authority, all the power is concentrated in one person, who is the king. Mm-hmm. In the old constitution, the king can dissolve parliament at any period of time without giving any justification. The king is the one who appoints the head of the government and the ministers, and who sacks the government or accepts the resignations.
Yeah, that's one of the demands of reform.
The king appoints the upper house of parliament completely. The king also appoints the judiciary with a special, you know, a special decree, and the king is the leader of the army. The king is the top guy in the navy and the air force, and so on. And the constitution gives him complete immunity, total and complete immunity. This was the old constitution. The new constitution does not even touch these authorities. Everything that I mentioned now remains intact, and in addition, in the new constitution, a new court was established, which is the constitutional court, and the king was given the power to appoint the judges in the constitutional court. So in addition to everything I said, the new constitution gave him a new authority over the constitutional court. So this is, and I can hardly describe this as a reformed constitution.
Then is this really appeasing people then? You know, because it seems, you know, in the spring, a call for a national dialogue. I mean, we've heard that over and over. A new prime minister, you know, we're at our third prime minister in less than a year. You know, this seems sort of politics as usual in Jordan, and it's striking to me, you know, that given everything happening in the region, to not really, you know, take a serious hard look. I think he's panicking a bit, of course, but the solutions he's coming up with don't seem to be anything new.
Yeah, because the threats is also minor, if you want to call it a threat. There's no real threat. I can hardly see that whatever popular movement in Jordan, if we are concentrated within the limitations of this of the post-colonial, I think Jordan is like Lebanon, it's like Bahrain. These are states that are very small, that are designed, they are of course fabric, or they were created by the British and French colonialist powers in the early 20th century after the First World War. And I think they are completely empty of any liberatory context. They cannot move, they cannot be sovereign states as such. We cannot say that Lebanon at any point in history can move to be a sovereign state, a very small state on the periphery of Syria, on the northern border of Israel, for example, divided into a trillion sects with no resources, no real populational weight, no geographical extension. Jordan is something similar to that. It's a very small country. We have no resources. The population is divided vertically between those of a Jordanian origin and those of a Palestinian origin. The Jordanians are further divided into tribes and regions and sects and families and so on. So within this context, I think we can have, if you look at how much this identity crisis has been deepening within the Jordanian society for the past 3 years, and this deepening of identity crisis has been taken and adopted by the political forces, I don't think there's a real threat on anyone in Jordan, but everybody is aware of this, even the political players. And are trying to manage a game where they try to take as much benefit as they can, and they are aligning themselves at the moment with the old guard, because the old guard has a tribal weight, they have tribal weight, they have some sort of political power and influence inside the security apparatus, inside the intelligence, inside key institutions in Jordan, and this way they are trying to move ahead with this kind of program. I think we have seen more, if you want to say, revolutionary expressions in Jordan. You remember 1989 and the what we call the April uprising in the south. It was much more concrete, much more radical than what we are seeing now. But the regime managed to survive and managed to manipulate the political game. I think what they are doing now is the same thing. They are managing the scene quite efficiently, and I doubt that we can see something similar to what happened in other Arab countries in Jordan. This is the responsibility mainly of the opposition forces that have adopted the fragmented identity rhetoric or speech, and because they stagnated themselves by adopting the regime's slogans of reform as well.
Right, right. Yeah, it's interesting that you brought up 1989. So, 1989, of course, massive protests, largely around economic issues, and the regime responded with a real political opening that lasted for a few years, as we know, and it really was a significant opening. But in some ways, it was kind of a bait and switch, stop focusing on the economy, we'll come distract you over here with the elections. Frankly, I think this is kind of what's happening in Egypt that makes me sad, that there's all the focus is on the technical reform of the elections and all the demands about the unjust economic system have been sort of pushed aside. Do you see, it seems in Jordan, again, the talk about the constitution is distracting away from real substantive issues that are going on.
I think the problem with want to say them. I try to call them Arab uprisings and not Arab revolutions because, for me at least, a revolution would have to substitute the existing regime with a completely new regime on the political and economic and social sides.
But I completely agree. We definitely haven't seen that in Egypt. I mean, Tunisia is an open question, but we're not even close in Egypt.
We haven't seen that in Egypt. We haven't seen that in Tunisia. We are not seeing it anywhere, and I think this is because for a long time, the Arab people were deprived of organizing, of know, going through debating their own existence by the oppressive regimes that were supported mainly by the U.S. and the European Union and other Western forces and powers. And the uprisings, I think, were mainly expressions of, you know, outburst and anger, but there is no philosophical, there's no political, ideological, even class nature that you may describe or that may relay or that may open up future changes in these countries. So this is why I think I don't think that this is a failure. I think this is a huge step forward for the Arab people, that they have taken their own matter into their own hands. For me, we have broken the curse, let's say, of hundreds of years of oppression, where we had no, you know, popular uprisings in the Arab region under no ruler or whatever. But I think this is a step forward, but it is not a complete step. We might see setbacks as well. This might not be surprising. It should not be surprising to see setbacks at some points. But I think it is, on the total, a huge step forward, and we should not overestimate what the result would be from such intifadas or from such uprisings.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, it's just an extraordinary year. But at the same time, it seems like Jordan and Morocco in particular, you know, they're trying to perform jumping ahead, perform being the good regimes that are, you know, always along the way wanted to be inclusive, to sort of get out of this. And, you know, maybe they're you know, as you say, maybe it is true that it's not even close to coming together as a movement to call for the end of the monarchy or call for the king himself to leave. But
well, I'm not a very good expert on Morocco, but for Jordan, I can tell you for sure that the monarchy has succeeded tremendously in establishing itself as a buffer zone between rival, if you want, sectors of society, and it has succeeded in portraying itself as the guarantor or the guarantee for everybody not to, you know. This is a very, very big issue here in Jordan, and I think they have succeeded. The monarchy have succeeded, and this is one of the main stability factors, I think, that it has on these lines.
So let me just for fun, let me defend the king. So it seems to me that there, you know, there are some signs that the king is serious about reforms, and so if you look to the 2001, when the parliament was dismissed, and it was, you know, almost 2 years before the new parliament, you know, so the parliament was suspended, and in the interim, the king, the government introduced over 200 temporary laws. Among those laws were laws that were pretty progressive towards women's rights and women's status, and they were among the first laws to be dismissed when the new parliament came into succession, into session in 2003. You know, is there a case to be made that the king really does want to push forward reforms, and maybe he's right that the political system, the party system's not ready. There's too many conservative forces, whether they're tribal forces or the old guard, that really they're only about protecting their interests. I mean, is there an argument to be made that he's really serious about this and he really does have to be cautious, or is this all just?
I don't know. For me. Let's talk about change, more or less, not reform, because I'm not, very much, I do not believe that reforms can be made into a system that is full of, holes and cracks and is set on itself on a faulty basis. However, I think change in Jordan is, cannot be understood outside a holistic vision, a macro vision. On the micro level, I think the regime has been able to tackle especially issues that are attractive to the West, like women rights, children rights. But for example, talking about social justice, the distribution of taxes and all these issues, of course, it has been maintaining itself as a regime that protects the few who are in power and the elite that represents those who are, in fact, you know, agents to the outside companies in the telecom business, in the car business, in every sector of Jordanian society. We don't have a real economy, as you know. I don't think that you can achieve reform without tackling all of these aspects and not just introducing minor legislations towards things that might be appealing, as I said, to a US or a European audience. I can tell you about one of the new constitutional reforms regarding freedom of creativity and regarding freedoms of the arts and of writing and so on and so forth. It has been in the constitution, it has been bound to the general ethics, and the new constitution states that freedom of creation and writing and the cultural freedoms and so on are guaranteed on the condition that they do not break the general ethics and the general, how can I say this in English, and the general, let's say, stability. Okay, this is a way to take away the freedoms that might be, that we think that if the king or the monarchy or the regime is moving towards a more liberal position, then in the new constitution, the freedoms towards writing and arts and so on have been strangled, or expression has been strangled, by introducing such a vague language. We are accustomed to such vague language in the law, in the laws that were issued along the past years, but not into embedded in the constitution itself.
Indeed, yeah. Okay. I want to actually talk also about a little bit more on economic issues, because, you know, there's one of the things that's frustrated me about the Egyptian case in particular is the sort of, you know, economic system as usual. The U.S. is, you know, happy to support the transition and then, you know, continues the same sorts of economic policies and the same sorts of investment. And so, you know, Jordan seems to have banked on this plan of economic reform that will supposedly, you know, help the masses of the people, and ultimately that will then lead to democracy. It's an old formula that historically hasn't worked, and Jordan is continuing on this formula. But I'm wondering about that. I mean, so you have a new economic elite that's displacing or challenging the old economic elite. There's resentments there. The traditional social bases want to protect, you know, what they see as this their power slipping away. And a lot of these economic reforms, especially the sort of foreign investment, the free trade zones, et cetera, seem to me are creating all kinds of dislocations and alienations. And it seems in some ways really important to think about the procedural issues of the Constitution and checking the king's power and being more inclusive, et cetera. But all of that could be accomplished if you're not attending to this economic system that seems to be worsening and worsening the context. I'm not sure where that can possibly go in a positive direction.
Well, I don't think there's any positive progress there. There's, for example, on the issue of corruption, there has been many demands to try and retake the money back into the treasury from different groups. This has not been the case. We haven't seen any. There were a lot of trials regarding many figures in the governing elite regarding corruption, but we have actually seen no results, and many of them are being tried.
So no results, like nobody's actually been prosecuted yet?
Yeah, there were prosecutions, but for example, one of them was Khalid Shaheen,
and he was
indicted, but for some reason he was given a free, access to London, and he just went to London and he stayed there, and the government had a very hard time bringing him back because there's no way that he can be brought back, because he was tried in front of a military court. You know, the corruption cases are being tried in front of military courts where nobody in the world accepts these as valid courts. So he can just simply buy his way out of prison into London and nobody can bring him back. Unless, like in Khalid Shaheen's case, they reached some sort of an undeclared settlement and he came back to finish his prison sentence. But other than that case, we are not hearing about major corruption issues that are being tried and we have definitive, let's say, judgments on those issues. This is on one side. Another big issue is that over the course of the past 15 years, the entire public sector has been privatized.
Right.
This public sector, you know, is public money. And the people, they were demanding that the public sector should be returned back into public property. And for example, many of the telecom sector, it was sold for pennies. You know, the telecom sector is one of the most profitable sectors in the world now. And our telecom sector was, sold for pennies for France Telecom, among other things. The cement factory, the main cement factory in Jordan, was also sold out. The potash and the phosphate mining companies were sold out. Even the Aqaba port, the management of the port was also sold to some, foreign investors. So we are seeing a country that has been completely privatized, and the neoliberal, market economy logic of cutting down on wages, layoffs, and the country, so the government, the regime has to compensate for its loss of cash, has resorted to increasing the taxes. We have a huge, huge burden of taxes on the population, and I don't think this will. It's impossible to reverse. The regime is not set.
Right, right.
It does not represent an interest group that is, that benefits from a reversal of these issues. What we will see is that more and more they are begging the Gulf countries to come invest. You hear of Jordan trying to join the Gulf Cooperation Council.
Yeah, how is that being received? It's not in the Gulf. Jordan's not a Gulf state.
Yeah, but it's a Sunni state, if you want.
I know, exactly. It's the Sunni Cooperation Council.
And
that's the real issue.
Yeah, it's a Sunni state, and it's, it has a very good intelligence and security apparatus that the Gulf might need. And many reports have been out that, Jordanian special forces were active in Bahrain, for example. And the Gulf are interested, I think, the Gulf states are interested in incorporating a stable Sunni monarchy in the face of what they call a Shiite danger from Iran and from, the Iranian crescent, which extends from Iran to Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. So, and also I think the Gulf states are interested in the Jordanian, expertise in security and in security forces and such things. So I think this is the main core here, but I don't think the Jordanians will benefit because they'll have to, Jordan would have to go into a huge legislative transformation to come into, in accordance with what the GCC countries have in their own. And I don't think that even, for example, you have poorer regions within the GCC, like Oman, you don't see money pouring into these countries or regions
result.
Just because they are part of the GCC. And I think this has been used by the regime here to propagandize or to, if you remember in 1994 when the peace treaty with Israel was signed, also the regime went into a propaganda, effort to convince the people that, now the U.S. aid will increase and we'll have lots of money pouring in because we are at peace with Israel and we'll have, lots of benefits. Nothing of that happened. In fact, the reverse happened. And I think what's happening with the GCC is the same thing, the same propaganda stunt, and nothing will yield except more stability to the regime itself, not to the people.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned sort of Jordan sending support to Bahrain, troops to Bahrain, I believe, to help crush the Shia uprising there. It sort of seems, you know, there's a little similarity. I mean, they're very different kinds of states and different sizes of population, but, you know, they're also monarchies in an age where there are very few monarchies left. They're monarchies that are trying to, you know, maintain and keep down, you know, a majority population, whether you call it ethnic minority or some kind of minority, but a sectarian minority. But that kind of makes me really nervous. It's sort of supportive for each other in repressing these kinds of movements.
Yeah, I think, well, I think it's also something that needs to be studied really well, that the monarchies have proven to be stable and have proven to show more solidarity together than the Arab Republican regimes. The main example of this is the long struggle or conflict between Syria and Iraq. Both of them were pan-Arab Ba'ath regimes. Both of them were republics, and both of them were in tremendous conflict with each other. Whereas on the other side, when you look at the Arab monarchies, they seem to be more stable for some reason, and they seem to be in solidarity together,
right,
in a way or another. I think this needs more attention to be studied, I think, and to be looked at really well. I think the case of Bahrain is peculiar because there you have, as I said, there's a minority that's crushing actually a majority with the help of the ruling elites in the neighboring countries or whatever, of the neighboring monarchies. I think the Bahraini regime tried to import the Jordanian model. There has been a lot of, it was not a monarchy in Bahrain. They transformed into a monarchy. They introduced parliamentary reform. They allowed not parties, but associations that represent parties. But in the general sense, they were unsuccessful because the monarchy itself represents one of the struggling factions inside the Bahraini social structure. So it's unlike, for example, the Jordanian regime or the Jordanian monarchy, where the Jordanian monarchy is actually a buffer or acts as a buffer between two, fabricated social structures.
Yeah, indeed. So what's next for Jordan? Are we just going to see more of this, weekly protests that aren't going to escalate in a particularly threatening way, and, constitutional reforms that aren't really going to reform a whole lot, and new elections next year? The king said a few weeks ago that he wanted to see his powers diminished within 5 years. I mean, are Jordanians buying any of that? Is that all just for Western audiences?
I think mainly yes. This is all for, for outside consumption, not for internal change. Change needs real force on the ground. I don't think the current situation in Jordan represents a real pressure on the regime to actually enforce change. Mm-hmm. The demonstrations that we see weekly are very small, from 20 to 30 people up to 200 or 300 people. If
so
the Islamists participated, then we might see 5,000 or 10,000 people. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, we are not seeing more than the 200, 300. This is not the people going down to the streets to enforce change. This is not the Egyptian model. This is not the Tunisian model. This is an elite opposition, seemingly opposition for me, because they are not, presenting real challenge, even on the political level, to what the regime is doing. They are within the lines of the regime, and I don't think that such a movement can achieve more than just, trying to re-establish the rules of the game within the regime itself, not presenting another model. endure them.
Right. Yeah, in some ways, I mean, you know, this project I've been working on for a number of years on protests in Jordan, it seems that a lot of these, you know, what you're calling the sort of elites that are out there now have been out there on a wide variety of issues over the past years. And so, you know, more and less in different cases, but, you know, absent a mass mobilization, absent the average Jordanians pouring onto the street, you know, I agree, it really is looking like a very different model. So maybe that's why the regime's
yeah,
not...
Yeah, and it's not just that, Gillian, that's, well, when the opposition go into dead-end political programs like reform, when the opposition raises the slogans of reform, the same thing that the regime itself has been raising for the past 5 years, you're putting yourself, you know, in a dead end that will lead nowhere. Many of the articles that I wrote, for example, criticized this, and well, I mentioned that why not just keep the slogans of against corruption, pro liberties, pro, you know, constitutional reform that gives back the authority back to the people and so on, without, you know, putting yourself in the dead end of raising a slogan calling for a reform of the regime. When you
right.
say that we want to reform the regime, that means that the regime itself is reformable, that the regime itself can be reintroduced as the, you know, a just system, as a system that can deliver social justice and can deliver economic, you know, reinventing the Jordanian economy into something that is more just you know, that gives justice to the entire population, that can you know, treat or remove this tremendous identity crack. This cannot be achieved, I think, with the current system and with the current course of events. We need a tremendous redefinition of things, and this cannot be done with the political tools that are being used by the opposition. So,
yeah. Well, do you have any last issues you wanna throw out before we wrap up?
Well, I don't know. The last thing I might add is that again, I should stress the fact that I don't think that change within very small countries like Jordan and Lebanon and Bahrain can be, you know, made easily, simply because I think these countries are completely, you know, the liberation
because of internal divisions.
Capabilities. You know, it's impossible to do that within this scope. I think these countries are mainly designed to continually be able to abort or kind of. I think what I look for is, and this is why, for example, I'm very pro the Syrian, what's going on in Syria at the moment. I think Jordan and the region, if the Syrian regime can be toppled, can move into further horizons. You know, Syria is the center of our region historically. Damascus has been the capital of the region historically. So there's a huge social, economic, and political reliance that can be, you know, positive if a popular uprising in Syria can succeed. Otherwise, I don't think that, you know, any movements in the peripheries like Lebanon, Jordan can achieve anything.
Yeah, but without a doubt, I mean, it's been an absolutely extraordinary and exhilarating year, and I think we're going to see a lot of politics as usual, a lot that's not going to change. But, you know, without a doubt, something has changed. The discourse has changed.
Yeah, and I think in the U.S., what's happened can also contribute. I think we've discussed the fact that we are not seeing concrete change in Egypt, for example, or Tunisia. I think part of this is because the regime itself has not been toppled completely, and this, in part as well, because of, you know, European support and the U.S. support to the old structures, not the heads of state, but the old structures of government that existed in Egypt. And in, I don't think that's a complete removal of the political structure in Egypt is in the favor of the U.S. or the United States. So they are supporting the old political structures with all they can.
Absolutely.
And I think a parallel movement in Europe and in the U.S., like what we are seeing now, can, you know, redefine, at least can redefine the political structures that the people want, and can help, you know, the people can help each other in different parts of the world, to fulfill what we have seen this year beginning. I think this is a beginning to a greater end, but a greater end would need more global, a more global movement, simply because the system of domination in the world at the moment is a global one. I don't think we can be very successful in confronting it without a global movement, and I hope that the Arab Spring would inspire such a movement, to mature.
I hope so too, and we'll, I'd love to talk again soon. I'm sure a lot's still going to continue to be happening in the next few months. So thank you, Hesham. It's been great talking to you. This has been bloggingheads.tv special edition on Jordan and the Arab uprisings. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Julian. I hope I don't get arrested after this, eh?
Take care.
All right, bye-bye.